This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Science Notes, a program on Otago Access Radio, brought to you by the Science News and Promotion Group at the University of Otago. Join me, Dave McMorran, as I chat with graduate science students. We'll find out about their research, why they do science at all, and what music they enjoy. Science Notes, Thursdays from 6:30 till 7 p.m. only on Otago Access Radio. Well, good evening to Science Notes again for another week. My name is Dave McMorran, and our guest tonight is Michaela Kirby-Crowe. Hi, Michaela.
Hi there.
Thanks for coming along.
No, good to be here. Good to be able to chat about what I do.
Yeah. So, Michaela's been... You finished?
Or no.
Still doing. A Master's in Wildlife Management at the University of Otago, which is part of the Zoology Department?
Yes, we're in the Zoology Department, but it's a different master's that they've just brought in this year. So
right.
18 months only, which is lovely.
New and interesting stuff. So we're going to be talking to her tonight about what she's been doing for her research for her master's. But we will start off with the first bit of music that Michaela's brought in, and that is...
Return to Innocence by Enigma. I picked this song because it takes me back to my childhood, being up the ski fields with kea everywhere, which are one of my absolute favourite birds, and I thought it was appropriate.
Cool. Here we go. listen to Science Notes on Otago Access Radio 105.4 FM, where we're talking tonight to Michaela Kirby-Crow, who is in the process of doing a Master's in Wildlife Management at the University of Otago. So how did you end up doing wildlife management?
It was quite a long process, really. I always liked science in school and biology, and I did my undergrad in Canterbury, starting off with the idea that I quite liked genetics. That kind of evolved and had a complete switch around, and I ended up doing ecology.
Right.
Still didn't know what I wanted to do, and I took my gap year off, which turned into 4 years, as it does. And over that time, I just spent quite a lot of time outdoors, learnt to love tramping, decided I wanted to spend most of my time just in the bush. And I met someone from DOC who told me about the wildlife management course. And it just kind of happened from there. I was doing one of my ski seasons in Wanaka, still floating around, not sure what I was doing. And I had multiple injuries that season. And that was when I was like, right, I'm done. Ski season's over. This is a sign. And yeah, woke up one morning and enrolled in wildlife management. And yeah, it was a really good decision. It's an amazing course.
It's quite new, isn't it, at Otago?
The Masters is new this year. The Wildlife Management Postgrad Diploma has been around for maybe 30 years. I'm not sure. It's been around for quite a while.
Okay.
So within like Department of Conservation and all of those kind of fields, it's quite a well-known course.
Right.
But this is the first year of a Master of Wildlife Management specifically. You could do a Master's of Science in Wildlife Management in the past.
Yep.
But yeah, this is new this year, so we're the guinea pigs.
Okay.
Yeah, see how it goes.
So is it like it says on the tin, wildlife management is about worrying about numbers of animals out in the wild and being concerned with how to manage the numbers and protect them and that sort of stuff?
Yeah, part of it is. It covers quite a wide range of things. Like, you can work in a whole bunch of different areas. There's like MPI, people who want to do stuff in fisheries and that kind of thing. People go to Fish and Game.
Right.
And then a lot of it is within Department of Conservation, and then you go into the wildlife management side of it itself. But yeah, it just depends what individual persons are interested in. You can just go out and work in the field, or you can
sort of just pick your creature and study that.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I like all creatures, which is going to be a bit of a struggle. So just going to kind of take the course that I've always done, which is just roll with it and see what happens.
Yeah.
At the moment, it's birds.
So you've been studying birds then?
Yes, I have.
New Zealand, of course, is well known for birds, which mostly seem to be green. But you studied some interesting coloured ones, at least.
I did, yeah, a little bit of variation.
But birds in New Zealand are always a bit of a worry, aren't they? Because they're not always the smartest things, and they tend to be a bit prone to being eaten by stuff.
Yeah, they just don't stand a chance in some cases, really. Not the brightest. So many things are against them. Like, every report you write at university based on New Zealand birds, one of the first things you'll put in there is they're threatened due to mammalian predators, due to habitat loss, due to all of these things, that just everything is against them.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of work going into trying to save them, and that's the best part of it. Like, we've done a lot of damage, and I think now we're at a point where we're trying really hard to make up for it.
And so you were studying kaka. At least that was the initial plan, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So tell us about kaka.
Kaka are a lowland parrot. There are two subspecies. There's North Island and South Island. The South Island ones are, they're not too different from the North Island, but like morphologically they're a bit more colourful, so they're really beautiful birds. Just hang out in lowland beach forests. And they have a huge range. They can travel amazing distances, and they'll do that for food. So they have particular food sources that they really like, and they've been shown to travel up to 50 kilometres to find such food sources. So that's pretty impressive.
So it's berries and such? Or?
Yeah, lots of berries. They eat like a small amount of invertebrates and stuff, but normally berries and fruits and all those sorts of things.
Right.
And if there's one particular thing that's fruiting at a certain time, then they'll just go for it until they're done, basically, gorge themselves.
And so are they, they're not endangered in the way that some of the birds are, I think, or am I wrong in saying that?
No, their official classification is nationally vulnerable.
Right.
So, yeah, not endangered, but they're not necessarily safe, and the South Island kaka population is somewhere between 1 and 5,000.
Oh, really? As small as that?
Yeah, well, it's... Yeah. We just don't know really exactly how many there are. Like, they think they have that range because it's assumed it's somewhere in the middle, so somewhere around 2.5 maybe.
I mean, chances are, because it's a big range.
Yeah.
But it could be plenty to not really that many at all.
Yeah.
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 So then part of what you're about then is trying to count them.
Yeah, that's it. Just, yeah, I was in the Upper Waikatapu Basin, just trying to figure out basically how many are out there, because what they want to do next season, hopefully, is get some radio tagged, and then from that they can look at nesting success, they can look at where the birds travel to, because there's a small population on the root burn that's been there for a while, but there are a few other birds around and they don't really know who they are, where they're from, where they go, like where they nest, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So, yeah, just in the process of learning more about them now.
When we were talking earlier, we were talking about how about kia, which are another sort of well-known New Zealand parrot. They're alpine. They're higher up, are they?
Yep.
Normally,
pretty much.
And the thing about kia, that the people who know what kia are, they'll know that they're easy to find because they come and find you.
Yeah.
Kaka, though, it sounds like are a bit different to that.
Yeah, they're a lot shyer. They don't... Well, it kind of depends, really. When they've been socialised and when they're used to being around people and they see people as a food source, as kia do, then they will come a lot closer to you.
Yeah.
But by nature, they are a lot shyer. With kia, even, if you get some that are in really remote areas that aren't used to people being around all the time, they're the same. They'll shy away from people a lot more. It's just in the really highly populated areas, like places like Arthur's Pass, where there's lots of traffic and ski fields and things, the kia will always find you and find anything of yours they can to demolish.
Yeah. So it's part of this sort of... intelligence that parrots have. They can work out what's good for them by hanging around people.
So
kaka will do the same given a chance, but
They have similar intelligence, but just not quite as, I don't even know the right word, sort of part curiosity, part mischievousness, if we want to put human traits on them or whatever, but yeah.
So then how did you go about trying to count them?
I was doing 10-minute counts every 500 metres along four of the tracks in the Upper Waikatapu area.
Right.
So just kind of walk along the track, and then I'd have my points I'd go to, jump off the track, try and be as far away from people as I needed to be so no one would talk to me. And then I'd just sit there for 10 minutes with my binoculars looking for all of the birds that I could see and listening for them as well.
Right.
Which was the most important part, really, because they're quite cryptic. I was looking at a few bird species, mohua and kakariki as well. Kakariki you can't really see, and mohua like to hang out in the canopy.
Right.
So the most important thing was just being able to pick up on their calls.
And if there were two kaka within hearing distance, can you pick the difference between them? Do they have different calls?
No.
So you're doing it more by just them coming from different directions?
Yeah, pretty much. You just kind of need to be, try and be as aware of your surroundings as you possibly can. And just if you hear a bird, like if I'd hear a bird sort of to my right about 50 metres away, and then you hear one just slightly off, then you'd probably assume it's the same bird. But if they're making noises at the same time in opposite directions, it took a really long time. I don't even know if I was that good at it after 3 months in the bush, to be honest. But yeah, I did my best, and you just need to just focus.
Yeah.
Focus is key. Yeah.
So you said you did four different tracks, but all in the same sort of region. Did you get similar sorts of counts? I mean, how many birds did you find, I suppose, it might be the first question. But
I have no idea. Like, I haven't done the stats yet, so I don't know about my actual abundance measurements.
Right.
There were definite differences between the tracks.
Yep.
I kind of made a gradient of where I'd find the most birds to where I'd find the least birds before I started, and it pretty much matched that. The Dart Valley was amazing. There was a couple of kaka, but heaps of parakeets and mohua up there, which is where they do a lot of work. The root burn's really good as well.
Yep.
And then my other valleys were the Capels and the Greenstone. Capels had particular areas where there was quite a few, but it has a lot of open areas as well. And then the Greenstone was my control valley where they've had no predator control, so I'd assume there to be less birds, because that was kind of my focus, just looking at the effects of predator control.
So what are the predators that are a problem for the kaka?
Stoats are the biggest problem.
Right.
Yeah, so it's all related to beach masting and stoat populations, pretty much. Kaka tend to only breed when there's beach masting or when there's a large beach flowering event. And they're cavity nesters, so they nest in holes in trees, which makes them really susceptible to stoats. Stoats just demolish everything. They kill without even eating. They're just vicious little creatures. And if you've got something nesting in a hole, then it'll just go for it. So yeah.
Regardless of whether it's hungry or not, it'll just...
Pretty much, yep. You see them just going around and attacking everything, smashing eggs, not even eating them, and it's just horrible. Pretty sad.
So is there trapping programs for stoats up that way?
Or? Yeah, there are. Yep, there's huge trapping programs. They have them every 100 or 200 metres along the tracks.
Right.
And they've done 1080 drops along there as well, so that will take out the mice and rat populations and then hopefully stop the stoat populations from increasing.
Do the stoats actually survive purely on eggs, or do they eat mice?
Everything.
Right, so if in theory all the smaller rodents... Mm. are removed, then the stoats will also potentially die out as well.
Yeah, that's what the 1080 dog battle for our birds thing was going for.
Right.
So they do the big 1080 drops when there's a beach mast, because during the beach mast, the mice will eat all of the extra seeds from the beech trees,
yep.
and then they increase, and then rats increase, and then stoats increase.
No. This is what's been happening in Franz Josef recently.
Yeah, it's
with
been...
With all the thousands of rats everywhere.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, they've various things happening around the country with it, but they do the 1080 drops to try and keep the mice down, and then it will stop that flow-on effect, which would lead to stoats...
Right.
Predating on all of the birds, yeah. And it seems to have worked. In the Dart Valley, they had a 80% drop in their mahua population a few years back, the year when they didn't do a 1080 drop, which was pretty heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And nothing like that's happened this year. From what I've seen, the numbers have increased a tiny bit. Like, my last counts after the young had fledged were way up. So
right.
It was really good.
So without wanting to get all controversial and political about it, in your experience of being out there, the 1080 drops are actually making a positive impact on the bird numbers rather than the opposite?
Yeah, on most of them. Yeah.
Right.
They're still having issues with Kea just because Kea eat everything.
Yeah.
But as far as most birds, it does really help, unfortunately. Poison's horrible. Nobody likes it. Nobody likes throwing mass amounts of poison out in the forests. But it does actually work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ends justifies the means.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, but yeah.
So you're doing all this on behalf of Doc because Doc presumably are interested. They're doing the ones who are running the trapping.
Mm-hmm.
So they're wanting that. They're caring about seeing whether that's having a positive impact on the bird numbers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it was just that, and just as an extra tool for kind of knowing exactly what's out there. And as they wanted me to set up a study that can potentially be done every couple of years, like if the study design and everything was good enough,
right.
Just so they can have ongoing monitoring. So what I've got will be kind of like a baseline study, and then potentially even other wildlife management students could use it as their project, and we can just continue to see how the populations are going, see if they're increasing or anything.
Cool. One question that I know I asked you this before, but it seemed you had a good answer, so I can ask you it again for real. When you say that the way that you counter them was just by walking along the track a certain distance and then just listening or looking for them, how do you know that you're not seeing the same bird following you down the track, in effect? How is there a way in which you can be sure that you're seeing different birds at each place?
Yeah,
because presumably that matters if you're the numbers to be believed.
It does. Well, you're never 100% sure, but the 500 metre distance was chosen because that should be far enough that I won't be seeing the same birds. Like, they probably wouldn't travel that much in the time it would take me to walk the 10 minutes.
Right.
And with the type of sampling I'm doing, it's distance sampling. So I'm measuring how far away from me all of the birds are. And that distance and the detection probability at different distances is put into a computer program,
right.
which will work out their abundance.
Mm-hmm.
And so hopefully, like, using the distance measurements is the most important thing. So even if I did happen to see or hear the same bird on my next count, the distance is the most important thing because it's all about the detection probabilities.
Right.
Like, it might mess up my proportions or whatever because I'm looking at percentages of how many birds I see per count.
Yep.
But as far as the actual distance, it should be fine.
Yep.
And, I think the 500 metres between each count was enough.
Yeah. Yeah. And I suppose, too, if if the long term plan is for someone to go back and do it again, even if there are inherent errors, dare I say it, in your numbers, they won't be any different next time.
Yes.
So if the numbers go up, the increase is going to be right, even if the actual numbers might be slightly out.
My numbers were pretty consistent with the other dock monitoring that have been going on there, because they've been doing 5-minute bird counts up there for a really long time.
Right.
And they've got line transects for Mohua and a whole bunch of data that they've had for that they've been doing for years, and all of my numbers were pretty on par with what they found. So, or from last year anyway. I don't know what this year's data was like, but yeah, in the same ballpark.
Yeah, cool. So, what to next? You've got some number crunching to do.
Yeah, I've got to do my write up. We've got one more paper this semester. It's part of the Master of Wildlife Management. You do your first year is 6 papers, and then your second year you've got 1 semester, you do 1 more paper, and then you do the write-up of your research.
Right.
So I'm just doing that, and I've got some other work for doc that I'm doing at the moment as well, so life's busy.
Plenty to be keeping on with.
Yeah,
definitely. Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming in and telling us what you've been up to.
Not a problem.
Very interesting.
It's always good to talk about it.
It's always nice to know that some you can do research that involves tramping around in the up in the Wakatipu.
It's just heaven. It's pure happiness, eh? Well, maybe one day I'll even get paid to do it. It'd be great. Yeah, maybe.
Cool. Thank you. And thanks for listening, everyone. Just as usual, this show will play again in, next Thursday night, and then you can listen to it at your leisure by by listening to it as a podcast from the Otago Access Radio website, which is www.oar.org.nz. We will go out tonight with Michaela's second piece of music, which she's brought along, which is
Somewhere Over the Rainbow by Israel. Can never pronounce his last name. But I chose this one because I have a little yellow ukulele called Buttercup that travels everywhere with me. Quite fond of my ukulele, and I thought this was a nice song to end on.
Excellent. Thanks for listening, everyone. Otago Access Radio, brought to you by the Science News and Promotion Group at the University of Otago. Join me, Dave McMorrin,
as I chat with graduate science students. We'll find out about their research, why they do science at all, and what music they enjoy. Science Notes, Thursdays from 6:30 till 7 p.m. only on Otago Access Radio.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.